Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do our surroundings affect the function and malfunction of our minds? Not long after Dr. Joel Gold started work in the psychiatric emergency room at Bellevue Hospital, he noted a surprising pattern of patients who believed their lives were being secretly videotaped for a broadcast audience, as in the 1998 Jim Carrey movie, The Truman Show. He didn't think the movie had caused their delusions, but it did seem likely to have influenced the manifestation of these patients' illnesses, which, as he will tell us, suggests a great deal about the proper way to approach caring for patients who may be affected by faulty genes and brain chemistry, but also by the societies in which their problems develop. Dr. Joel Gold is Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry at NYU School of Medicine and has a therapy practice in Manhattan. His new book is called Suspicious Minds: How Culture Shapes Madness. The book's co-author is Ian Gold, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Psychiatry at McGill University and Joel Gold's brother. Joel, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the first time you encountered a patient who had what you came to call Truman Show delusion.
A man I came to call Albert came into our unit on October 31st, 2003. I remember it was a Friday. It was Halloween, and it was kind of late in the day. So being a Friday, you know, stuck in our minds, it's never really a wonderful thing when we get a late admission. It means instead of getting out at 6, we'll be getting out at 9. And he was a lovely guy. He had come to New York from out of state. He had had the impression for a number of years that he was essentially the star of the greatest, largest reality television show in the world, that everyone around the world was watching him, and there were cameras everywhere, including in his eyes. And he was very, very obviously concerned about this. Given that it had come to light, he thought that if he had come to New York City, he was going to test his hypothesis. If the World Trade Center was in fact destroyed, he would consider that he might be mentally ill. But if they were still standing, it would confirm that they were, in fact, they looked like they were destroyed, only for his reaction for that particular scene in the movie.
It's an interesting form for a delusion to take because on the one hand, you feel sort of victimized and unable to shake the fact that people are following you around. On the other hand, I guess you have this sense that you must be special if the whole world is essentially organized around this stunt.
Yeah, that's not so uncommon in general with respect to paranoia and persecution, as well as grandiosity, as we call it. So if the whole world is watching you, then that's pretty scary, but of course you're also the most famous person in the world. And you could think of other delusions where someone thinks, you know, that the CIA is following them out to get them. So that's pretty scary. You know, they feel persecuted, but at the same time, gee, if they're following me around, I guess I must be, you know, of some import to them.
So just briefly, for people who never saw the movie or saw it 16 years ago, just remind us of the basic premise of The Truman Show.
Sure. So The Truman Show stars Jim Carrey as a sort of mild-mannered guy who was adopted in utero by a large corporation. And from the time, again, he was essentially born until the time the movie begins, he's around 30 years old, his entire life is a reality show. His best friend Marlon, named for Marlon Brando, his wife Meryl, named for Meryl Streep, everyone in his life, including the guy who sells him his coffee in the morning, all of the people who pass him wordlessly in the street, they are all actors in the most popular show in the world. Everywhere else in the world, they're watching Truman Burbank's life. That's his name for Burbank Studios in Hollywood. They're all watching him, and he is the only person on Earth who does not know that he's on a reality television show. And the movie is really the story of Truman gradually realizing that his life is this counterfeit existence and his attempt to escape the show, essentially.
So you started seeing similar cases on occasion, but you say that it took you a while to register any sort of pattern.
That's right. In psychiatry, especially in an acute setting like Bellevue Hospital, where we have so many psychiatric patients come through both a psychiatric emergency, where we have actually a separate emergency room from the medical emergency room strictly for psychiatric patients. We have 10 or 12 inpatient psychiatric units, each with about 25 to 30 beds. So there are so many people who come through with all manner of very unusual ideas and delusions that any single one, though it might be interesting, and we might remark after we interview the patient, oh, that's quite a an unusual belief, but then we go on and treat the person, and hopefully they get better and they leave in a little while. But when you see something new once, twice, three times, it starts to stick in your head, and that's what happened with these Truman patients. By the third, fourth, maybe even the fifth patient, having heard them say, "My life is like the Truman Show," three of the five guys mentioned it by name, I started to think, well, gee, there's something to this. I had not heard anything of this nature in the years I've been practicing psychiatry. So I started to think, there might be something to look into here.
And to be clear, and I mentioned this in my introduction, but you are not saying that you think watching this movie made people mentally ill.
By no means. Nobody walks into a movie theater of any kind, and they're well when they walk in, and they're mentally ill when they walk out. I suppose some films are very moving, and we might walk in and leave crying, or some might affect us in a way that makes us anxious, or makes us think. That's what a lot of movies are about. But in this case, The Truman Show resonated with the experience that these guys were having. Some of them had already felt that their world was somewhat off. Maybe just it didn't feel quite the same. People that they knew for a long time seemed different to them. And when they saw the movie, they said, aha, well, that explains it. That would explain my life experience, because that's very much what happens to the Jim Carrey character. Everything is going along. He loves his wife. His friend is his friend. And as things start to shift for him, his experience of it shifts. Instead of being this very, again, mild-mannered guy, he starts to feel the world is revolving around me, and I need to get out of this place. He lives on an island, essentially. Sea Haven is the sound studio, and he has difficulty because the director doesn't want him to leave the island, because of course then he would realize that he was being filmed. So for those guys, I think it really resonated sort of going forward. For others, it's more retrospective. They have this experience, and then they remember the film, and they say, I remember seeing that movie, and gee, at the time I thought it was just a piece of entertainment, but really maybe that's signaling what I'm going through now.
So is this related to the fact that in past eras people would feel some delusions or have some paranoia and feel that they were being followed by, like, the CIA, or feel that their next-door neighbor was a witch or something hundreds of years ago?
Yeah, that's what we think. By no means do we think that the Truman Show delusion is a new kind of illness. In fact, delusions themselves are not usually considered illnesses. They're symptoms of a psychotic illness like schizophrenia. They are psychotic symptoms like hallucinations, hearing voices, or seeing things. So delusions are unusual or strange beliefs that people hold on to very strongly, despite the fact that there is evidence to the contrary. And my brother and I feel, and many psychiatrists would agree, that there are certain forms of delusion, about a dozen, we reckon. And over the course of time, the forms of those delusions, again, paranoia, grandiosity, perhaps the idea that one is no longer living, it's kind of an unusual one. They feel that either they don't exist or the world doesn't exist. Religious delusions, again, I'm the second coming, things of that nature. Those things are basically fixed, but as time changes, as the era changes, and as the environment and culture changes, the paint that fills in the blank canvas also changes, and that would explain in part why we feel that the Truman Show delusion has manifested itself.
How did we understand delusional thinking before modern psychiatry emerged?
In the more ancient past, people had very different ideas, some more useful, some less. There were a lot of religious beliefs that people who had these ideas, not just delusions, but again, hallucinations, were touched in some way, by God. There was a lot of a religious element to it, that perhaps God was speaking through these people. And so in some cultures, people who had these delusions were listened to quite closely. In other forms, sort of the flip side was the case, that people who had these ideas were being punished in some sense. There was, you know, a guilt or sin that they had somehow wronged man or God, and for that reason they were experiencing what they were. And so, again, over a shift in time, we've gone sort of back and forth over what mental illness and what psychotic illness is, whether it's more spiritual, psychological, physiological, and perhaps we could touch on that, how, you know, for a while it was very much a physiological idea. People felt, that there were humors, right? The four humors were out of balance. Bile, you know, different color, red bile and black bile, and all of these sort of biological ideas, which ultimately, you know, we reject. But the notion that there was something wrong with the body and the brain was actually quite in vogue, really many, many years ago, thousands of years ago, perhaps. And then over the course of time, we've shifted, in this century, last century, more into the psychological, and now back to the biological.
Yeah, you have a really interesting example in the book of trying to understand, say, an earthquake by looking at simply the atoms that are involved in the mechanisms of movement of the earth.
Yeah, we use that as a metaphor. People are so enamored with the brain and with the physical nature of mental illness that we're trying to break it down in such a fashion that many people, yesterday I read an article that a gentleman had donated $650 million for brain research, particularly psychiatric brain research, and that's wonderful, generous, but it's essentially all about the brain. There's an initiative called BRAIN, which is an acronym for something I'm not even sure about, but it's also about genes and brains, and the idea is if we understand literally the molecules of ourselves, what our genes are, what our brains are made of, then we could understand mental illness in some, you know, optimal sense. We could really figure out everything, and, you know, in some sense, that's, I suppose, true of everything in the world, right? We're all made of atoms, but that doesn't really help very much when we're trying to come up with a theory of madness. And the, again, coming back to your point, the metaphor is, well, sure, I mean, earthquakes are also about a bunch of atoms that are moving around, but that doesn't really help us to describe it. So instead, we talk about plate tectonics and how, you know, large masses of atoms are moving around in such a way that it helps us to understand why earthquakes happen, perhaps how we can avoid damage in the future. That's much more useful. And so this monomania, if you will, about the physical nature of mental illness, we think is understandable in some sense why people would want to move in that direction, but we don't think it's particularly or always that useful.
My guest is Dr. Joel Gold, Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry at NYU School of Medicine with a therapy practice in Manhattan. His new book, co-authored with his brother Ian Gold, is called Suspicious Minds: How Culture Shapes Madness. We'll resume the conversation in 2 minutes. You can call to join it at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Dr. Joel Gold, who is Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry at NYU and co-author of the new book Suspicious Minds, How Culture Shapes Madness. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Joel, what is the relationship between the normal, even protective suspicions and anxieties of mentally healthy people and the ones that spin out of control for those who are experiencing mental illness and delusion specifically?
Well, my brother and I offer a theory of delusion that it's an environmental necessity, something that's helped us over the course of millennia, and that delusions may be the price that we pay to have this system in place. It's a system that we call the suspicion system, and we believe that the brain, in large part, is used to negotiate the social world, that in order to survive, we have to live in communities, and as time has changed, obviously, those communities have grown larger and larger, and we feel that it's important to know who around us is a good actor and a bad actor, someone who may have our best intentions at heart and some people who are trying to take advantage. If you live in a city hundreds, again, thousands of years ago, a city of, not even called a city, a village of 80, 100, 150 people, you pretty much knew everyone who lived in it. And you knew the bad actors, so you might feel relatively safe, but you still need to keep your guard up. As cities have grown larger and larger, it's hard for the brain to keep focus on who's around us and who might intend to do us harm. So we think that there are a couple of systems in place, one called the suspicion system, which is sort of the idea of if you're walking in the forest and you hear a branch crack, your initial sense is to jump, right? Mm-hmm. The fight or flight response is that an animal that may attack. And then we have something called the reflective system, wherein we look around and we say, no, it was just the wind. And then, you know, maybe our pulse slows down and we continue our walk. Similarly, we think if we have something that at first may signal, oh, this person may want to do us harm, the suspicion system kicks in, appropriately so, because we don't want to be taken advantage of, harmed in some fashion. And then this thing we call the reflective system will slow down and say, no, you know what, this person doesn't in fact mean us harm, we just had that sneaking suspicion for a moment. We believe that delusions come up when the suspicion system sort of goes out of control, breaks down in some fashion, or the connection between the two no longer exists. And therefore, that fight-or-flight response, so to speak, the intent to harm that initially kicks in, doesn't go away and takes over. And that's what's driving the delusion, the notion that in social factors, people are trying to intend us harm, and people who hold these delusions act rationally in a sense, because if you feel that someone is intending to do you harm, you act appropriately. But of course, when you're wrong, it manifests in delusional fashion.
Hmm. Do most people experience some kind of mild delusion at some point in their lives, or are these limited to people who are pretty recognizably mentally ill?
You know, that's a really great question. There are studies that show that something like 17% of all people in the general public have a psychotic experience. Mm. And, of course, most of the population do not seek mental health treatment for psychosis. So what does that really mean? At any moment in time, you can come up with an image, say, the shirt over the chair when one goes to bed, and you open your eyes, and for a quick second you think, there's someone in my room, someone is sitting in that chair, and for, again, a quick second, your heart races until you realize, oh no, it's just the shirt that I threw over the chair. Is that a delusion? Of course not. That's just what we call an illusion. Are there times where you may think, you know, I think my boyfriend may be cheating on me? And you don't really have a sense why that might be. Again, you know, you might get some late night phone calls. You may find some charges on the credit card that don't really look familiar. Again, is that delusional, even if it turns out not to be true? Probably not. In fact, it might be a very good thing. You might realize, you know, if I'm not a better partner, my partner might leave me. Mm-hmm. So, again, that's sort of the suspicion system doing things that it ought to do. Where do you draw the line between delusion and ideas that are unusual? And that's a tough question. You know, we suggest that if someone believes that they were kidnapped by aliens and taken to another planet and examined and brought back to Earth, they might be considered psychotic. If someone believes that this has happened to other people, again, more of a conspiracy theory, they're not considered delusional. They're considered someone with an unusual conspiratorial idea. So where, again, do we draw that line? You know, I'm a sports fan, as I'm sure many of your listeners are, and we have all kinds of superstitions. If I stand on one foot, if I wear my hat backwards, you know, my team might win. Of course, we know this is not really true, and yet we find ourselves doing it. Is that really a delusion? No, we don't consider that a delusion, maybe because everyone does it. If someone thinks that, you know, if they climb to the top of the Statue of Liberty and their team will win, well, you know, maybe that takes on a delusional quality. So it really is not as easy as people suggest, and it's really, unfortunately, I think at times up to the decision of a psychiatrist or a number of psychiatrists to determine what is or what is not a delusion.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now. We have Samantha on the line in North Richland Hills. Hi, Samantha.
Hi. Actually, I have a question that has been plaguing me for years. When I was younger, I watched The Truman Show, and ever since then, I've just had this horrible feeling of paranoia. When I got to the age of 18, I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. So I was wondering if The Truman Show could have been some kind of a trigger to show early signs of bipolar disorder, or if it's just unrelated.
So if I understand you correctly, you developed essentially what I'm talking about as far as The Truman Show. I guess that's true, right after you saw the film. And how old were you at that time?
8.
You were 8 years old. You saw the film. And at that, from that point on, you held this belief. Is that fair to say?
Off and on, yes. It's embarrassing to admit, but
no,
yes.
No, you shouldn't be embarrassed. My goodness. Well, there are a couple of important points to make there, and you might represent both of them. One is that children often have this kind of idea, which again we wouldn't consider a delusion. As we know, children are imaginative, and many people, after I talked about this concept and you know, we've been writing about it and speaking about it, people will come up and say, you know, I actually thought when I was 7 years old that I had a television show, or that maybe my life was like a movie, and it tended to recede over the course of time as they entered adulthood. In your case, as you became older, you describe having bipolar disorder. Many of the patients that I've treated with the Truman Show delusion have bipolar disorder. Usually they have that experience when they're in the grips of a manic episode. It does not sound like, you know, from what I can gather, that you are. Of course, we're only speaking for a few minutes here, but if you have it in a more ongoing fashion, that is an important thing to discuss with a mental health practitioner, because it's if it's an ongoing thing, not just happening during these episodes, and of course, not to get into too much detail, but even bipolar disorder is something that has become kind of difficult for people to diagnose appropriately. A lot of people are diagnosed with bipolar disorder that, you know, I don't think ought to be, and perhaps the opposite as well, particularly in children. So I wish I could give you a more straightforward answer. Again, I don't think that the movie by any means caused you to develop bipolar disorder. It may have, again, explained or resonated with you what your experience was, and the movie can become, someone recently used the word that I like very much, scaffolding. It becomes the scaffolding of your experience, and then you kind of think, well, yes, this is what I'm having. But it sounds like it may have predated the movie in some fashion, if I understand correctly.
So you mentioned earlier, Joel, that in times when we were living in much smaller circles, it was sort of easier to know who was good, who was bad. We certainly had background information on everybody we would encounter. You share some fascinating ideas in the book about the potential stresses created by the extra relationships that we have to navigate in the modern world. We're in these densely populated communities, and we have an entire globe full of potential online relationships.
Well, that's really important, and that's one of the reasons why we think that the Truman Show delusion may be, in some fashion, a little bit different, or we may have crossed the line, unlike in the past where we had gone, let's say, as the example we've been using from the Cold War, the CIA is following me, although, of course, CIA still exists. To, Al-Qaeda is after me. Those things would not be surprising. But there's good evidence, mostly from the United Kingdom, but we all accept it, that living in large urban environments actually raises the chance of someone becoming psychotic. So if you live in a town of 5,000, and you're sibling who shares your genes lives in a town of 5 million, the sibling with who lives in a larger town has a greater risk of becoming psychotic. And given that urban living is a risk factor, and again, we can understand perhaps some of the things we've been talking about, more people we don't know, we can't keep track of, more people who might mean us harm, and there are other elements as well, drugs and discrimination, a lot of things that we find in large cities, not that they don't exist in small towns as well. And so when we turn to the internet and Facebook and Twitter and, a teenager today, if you ask them how many friends he has, you might say, oh, I have 10,000 friends. Well, how many real friends does he have? How often does he sit down face-to-face and talk to someone, something that would be protective from a mental health perspective, right? Having a good network of family and friends who care about you and love you. And instead, we have not just kids but adults, too, who live in this environment, this virtual world of sort of an infinite number, or at least, 7 billion people who may mean to do us harm. We may not initially feel that way. We're going online for entertainment or to learn things. But for people who are at risk for becoming psychotic, that might start out that way. But over the course of time, the notion that people do mean us harm, and of course there are people who, steal our identities, credit card fraud, or, the Nigerian prince, who's suddenly calling you and saying, send me $500 or what have you. Those real risks. And we can get more into it, but the whole notion of, the surveillance society that we do live in, what do these large, cities that we've manufactured online, what impact does that have on our brains and our minds?
It's almost like we live in two places at once.
In some sense, that's true. We live in the families and small communities that we surround ourselves with, again, that usually are protective. Again, this is assuming that there isn't abuse and sort of bad conditions, but people have their families and their churches and other groups, and if you live in a small town, that can be very, very pleasing, and people feel very secure. The notion of living in a small city versus a large city, it's not just being raised and born in a small versus a large city. It's when. So if someone moves to a large city before the age of 15, their risk is going to be higher than if they move when they're 40, when their brain is still developing at 14 and 15. And then these kids that we're raising now, they're being weaned on iPads. So again, what is this doing to their brains? I'm, middle-aged man, so I can, in one sense, live in the world that you describe with my family and my friends when, this kind of thing just did not exist. and I can also go online, and, you know, maybe that could be distressing to me if particularly I have, you know, a predisposition biologically to becoming psychotic. But what about a young man or woman, a child really, who is growing up online where they could be chatting with someone on the other end, you know, of the world, really?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Tony on the line in Dallas. Hello, Tony.
Hi. My question is twofold. The first thing is I had read about the separation of the dream state and waking consciousness being dependent on the serotonin nervous system, and I wondered if some people have a breakdown there that causes an altered mental state and creates delusions. The second part is, what about people who through, say, yogic practices or even drugs deliberately create this imbalance? And are the delusions a result of that, or do they just bring out delusions that they were unaware of?
Yeah. Thanks,
a lot of very interesting points there, just to touch on them briefly. There certainly is biology at play. We're not suggesting that biology doesn't count. So whether it's serotonin or dopamine or other neurotransmitters gone awry, you know, we have no argument against that. And there are many theories as to why that might be, or different parts of the brain. And, you know, not to get into it, but that's what a lot of biological psychiatrists spend their time arguing about. With respect to the second point, that's also a really important thing for us to know about. Yes, a lot of people, young and old, use recreational drugs to have these unusual experiences, and for a short period of time, I suppose it might be, you know, for them an interesting experience to feel that they're living in the Matrix or what have you. But they think that this will last, you know, a few hours, I suppose, or what have you, and then they'll come back to their regular lives, and it'll be like almost like a movie experience. But, of course, as I think most of us know, these drugs can be very, very dangerous, and some people enter into that world, but they don't come out of it. So you mentioned yogic world. If you're talking about meditation and yoga, which I think are very healthful things, people can use it as a skill, but most people don't get stuck in whatever state they enter doing yoga or meditating. But if they use these substances, the brain really may go into a state that they can't exit from. And finally, the point of...
Let me jump in because we have to take a quick break, and I'll let you finish in just a minute. My guest is Dr. Joel Gold. He is professor of psychiatry at the NYU School of Medicine and has a therapy practice in Manhattan. His new book, written with his brother Ian Gold, is called Suspicious Minds: How Culture Shapes Madness.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Dr. Joel Gold, Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry at NYU's School of Medicine and co-author, along with Ian Gold, of Suspicious Minds: How Culture Shapes Madness. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. And before the break, Joel, you were finishing up your answer with regard to the use of drugs that might cause people to be in a sort of delusional state.
Yeah, exactly. The last point I was going to make is that when people, particularly young people, use drugs, let's say marijuana, and they end up having a psychotic illness, let's say schizophrenia, we're not really sure, and we're still not sure, whether that person would have become delusional anyway, and whether it was just sort of moved up a little bit. Instead of becoming ill at 19, they're now ill at 18 because they used the drug, or whether that wouldn't have happened at all, and whether the drug in and of itself would have caused the illness. And there is some research evidence of late that particularly cannabis, marijuana, is something that can really increase the rates of psychosis. So we're moving away from the idea that, well, you know, that young man or young woman would have become schizophrenic a little bit later, to the idea that if they never used the drug, they may never have developed it. And that's something very important to take into account from a, you know, public health perspective.
So what does a theory of mental illness that takes into account physiological changes in the brain as well as the impact on culture suggest about the best ways to care for people who present with these illnesses?
We always, I personally certainly believe that the most important element for care in psychiatry, and frankly probably any discipline, is the relationship between the doctor and the patient. And when you're dealing with people who have delusions, particularly paranoid delusions, it's much more challenging to make that connection. And when you're talking about something like the Truman Show, where I'm not Dr. Gold, I'm just an actor playing Dr. Gold, it's even more difficult to make that connection. And in the past, for many, many generations now, or at least since, you know, the last century, people would be given, and are still given more and more, antipsychotic medication in order to control, and usually not cure, but control the symptoms of psychosis. Again, voices and delusions and the like. And these antipsychotic medications can work wonders and have saved many, many lives. And I prescribe these medications. I have prescribed them innumerable times, both at Bellevue and even currently. So I'm not against medication by any means, and that's for psychosis as well as other forms of mental illness, depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, your recent caller has. So medications have their place, but in other areas, let's take depression, it wouldn't be uncommon for someone to go see a therapist and talk about whatever it is that's troubling them that may be leading to or making their depression worse, and they're also taking an antidepressant. In illnesses like schizophrenia or someone who might have the Truman Show delusion, the idea that, well, you know, they're not going to be able to engage in any kind of talk therapy because, you know, they're crazy and their ideas are so crazy that it doesn't make any sense to talk to them because we're not going to be able to have a conversation. So here's your medication and please take it and we hope you don't have too many side effects and come back in a month and I'll ask you again if you still have these strange ideas. I believe, and I think there are more and more people who believe, that you can actually talk to people with these kinds of ideas. It's not easy by any means, but if you make the effort to connect to these individuals who have delusions and have other symptoms of psychotic illness, that over time you can make that connection, that therapeutic alliance, that working alliance, whatever you want to call it, the doctor-patient relationship, and in time, you can actually help them. There is a therapy. People might be familiar with cognitive behavioral therapy, but that's usually used, again, for depression and anxiety and things of that nature. But there is something called CBT for psychosis. We hardly ever use it. I just found a paper. It's from a few years ago that said that there were something like a dozen people in the country who practiced CBT for psychosis, and we have, you know, many millions of people, or at least several million people in this country who are psychotic. So it's really out of whack. But my hope is that over the course of the next several years, more and more people will be trained to do this kind of therapy, and people will be able to have both talk treatment as well as medication treatment.
And there may be a benefit simply to the existence of a relationship with a compassionate person in the form of the psychiatrist that the patient comes to feel he or she can trust.
Absolutely. This speaks to almost every therapy that one does. People tell me things that they've not told their spouse. People have told me things that they've not told essentially anyone ever. And that's not psychotic people. Those are people who are, again, just anxious or depressed or just want to understand themselves better. So you can imagine someone who has really frightening thoughts that people are after them or that they're hearing voices from the devil or what have you, and to have a safe space where they can say really anything. They can talk about these things. They can curse me. They can do anything other than, you know, physically harm me, and they're okay. I'll listen to it, and I'll, either have something to say or I'll just be a sounding board. And this can be really, really therapeutic to have someone that they can trust. Some people trust their family. Some people don't, unfortunately. But if they can develop that relationship, it can be, again, a really safe space. And that in and of itself, many people believe, and I certainly agree with, is therapeutic. Just, again, to have a best friend, to have a spouse, to have a parent that you can tell anything to, that you can lean on in any experience. That's true of having a therapist as well, a psychiatrist who can do that for you.
There is a sort of cruel irony to the fact that just as patients' symptoms start to manifest themselves, their illness actually serves to further isolate them from their communities.
That's a really good observation, actually one that I haven't really thought much of, but that's exactly right. Some people, one guy in particular, came up with a theory of delusion that it meant to do the opposite, that if people had the idea that their insides were rotting or, you know, these terrible things were happening to them, they thought they were dying, that it would actually bring the society in and they would be brought back into the community. Of course, we don't think that that's really true because, for one, after short order, people would recognize that that wasn't true. And if anything, they would, you know, people would be angry with them for sort of making these things up, even though when people are delusional, they're not lying about it. But that's just the case. I've been getting a lot of calls in the last couple of weeks since the book was released from family members who are just torn up. Their children often are doing just awful things to themselves. They don't have to be doing. They're living homelessly, even though they have a family who wants them to come back to them. They are not eating. They are perhaps threatening to kill themselves because they're so tormented. And the very people who want to help them, be it family or society at large, we have many organizations, hospitals, who want to help these people, but they are so terrified and they're so so much clinging to their ideas that they're just not able or not willing or not wanting to engage with their loved ones. And it's very painful for them and even perhaps more painful for their loved ones because the loved ones see that it's really a function of mental illness. The people who are having these delusions don't think there's anything wrong with them. So they're suffering, but they're suffering because the world doesn't know what they know. Whereas in this case, you know, for family members and loved ones, we know the opposite.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Brett in Dallas. Hi, Brett.
Hey, it's an interesting show, and I love the show, Chris.
Thanks.
So I just was wondering, you know, this was based on the Truman Show, and if you see it with other movies that come out and other popular culture items, and then how much research you may do in advance of, you know, movies that are coming out to pay attention to what, you know, patients may be saying as they come in, or just as the ability to kind of relate to them. I'm thinking movies like Shutter Island and Inception and, you know, you mentioned The Matrix and Fight Club and just movies that kind of really grip your interest like that.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I think something like The Matrix, which really causes a lot of people to question reality, is something that we have seen. Colleagues of mine have talked about, and one patient of mine have talked about patients who had that very idea. And again, some people don't think of it as delusion. There are people who study it and in academic circles and think, you know, maybe we're all living in a simulation. And again, since they're talking about all of us, not just themselves, they're not considered delusional. You mentioned Shutter Island. We mentioned it in the book as actually a really great way for some people to understand what others may be going through when they're experiencing these kinds of hallucinations and delusions, whether something like that can plague someone and actually tip them into a psychotic episode. It's really hard to know. I don't believe that it's any one event, any one film, any one experience that can cause someone to become psychotic. They may be in the early stages, And just like the marijuana might push them in, you know, certain cultural factors, again, you know, the stories about the NSA, that our phone calls are being monitored, our emails are being read, I think, you know, the realities of that, maybe more so than film, you know, those realities may have a very corrosive effect on our minds.
Do you think it's easier to subscribe to a purely sort of neurological understanding of mental illness if you don't deal with patients on a regular basis?
For a number of reasons, I think it's much more understandable for people to think of mental illness as much like they do other illnesses, you know, diabetes or heart disease, and, you know, you fix the heart and you can fix the brain. I think for some people it's also, it makes them feel a bit better. You know, I'm okay, my brain is okay, and so I'll never be crazy. And so crazy people are over there and I'm over here. And when you talk about the environment as opposed to just biology, it can make people feel a little bit uncomfortable that, you know, well, there isn't a real fine, sharp line between the mentally ill and the mentally well. So I think in that sense, it's helpful. And in another way, you know, some of the old theories of the psychological reasons were really quite upsetting and awful. There was a period where in psychoanalytic period when that was really the mode, that mothers, particularly parents, but especially mothers, were the cause of schizophrenia. They were called schizophrenogenic mothers. Hmm. That they were cold, and that they, you know, they were the reason that their children were ill. And this was really before the age of you know, biological psychiatry. So in that sense, it's been a really wonderful thing to say, you know, your child is ill not because you're a bad parent, but because, you know, their brain chemistry is messed up. And in large part, of course, that's true. But it doesn't mean that children who are abused or people who live in large cities or immigrants aren't at higher risk. So it doesn't have to be an either or. Of course, the biology is there, but to ignore the environment altogether, you know, we think is a mistake.
The way you describe that line between those who are mentally healthy and those who are mentally ill made me think of like one of those color blindness tests where if you stand far back, it's really clear where the letter is. But if you get up very close, the circles start to seem so like one another that you can't really see which is which.
Things are quite blurry. And when you talk to someone or someone might at a cocktail party or, you know, at a barbecue might say, you know, I've had this strange idea and I don't know, you know, should I see a doctor about it? You know, maybe it's not a big deal. It's really hard, you know, for us to know. And people come to me and they say, you know, doctor, I'm worried I'm going crazy. And frankly, when people say that, chances are that they're not, because it means that they have what we call insight, right? They have the knowledge that their brains might not be functioning well. So it really does become quite blurred. But, you know, maybe that's for the best. Maybe the idea that we're not so different from one another can increase, you know, compassion and sympathy and empathy for those who are clearly, you know, struggling.
Dr. Joel Gold is Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the NYU School of Medicine, and he has a therapy practice in Manhattan. His new book is called Suspicious Minds: How Culture Shapes Madness. The book's co-author is Ian Gold, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Psychiatry at McGill University and Joel Gold's brother. Joel, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.